7 degrees, both Kenosha and Racine. Wind chill, 3 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited to be able to spend the first few minutes of today's morning show talking with Edward J. Williams III, who is a Corps officer and pastor for the Salvation Army, Racine Corps, and Community Center. And of course, all of us, if we are out and about during this holiday season, surely have seen those iconic red kettles, and often with the ringing of bells. And it's, of course, an opportunity to gather up funds that can go to the needy. But exactly how does all of this work? Well, that is why Captain Williams is here to talk about the work of the Salvation Army and the kind of good work that they seek to do in the community, actually all year round. And we'll also find out a little bit of kind of the behind the scenes in terms of where these red kettles come from and how they are distributed and how they are manned, if you will. Most important of all, we will talk about the enormous good that comes from this annual fundraising effort, which runs until noon on December 24th, Christmas Eve. Edward J. Williams III, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I should mention that a friend of mine, John Costable, who you were telling me is on your advisory board,
yes,
thought it would be a great idea to have this conversation, and I heartily agree. I think for a lot of us, we are familiar with the name Salvation Army, but don't know a whole lot beyond that. And in fact, I suspect a whole lot of people don't even realize that the Salvation Army is, in fact, a church.
Absolutely.
Let's just get a little bit of the background of that first, and then we'll get to the Red Kettle campaign. But first, tell us what you think our listeners might appreciate knowing and find interesting about the Salvation Army itself.
Yeah, so the Salvation Army was founded in the East End of London back in the mid-1800s by a Methodist preacher, William Booth, and his wife, Catherine Booth, both individuals who were led by the Holy Spirit to open up a space and opportunity for the lowly of society to have a place to gather, to congregate, to hear the Word of God, to have their physical needs met. What you'll find is that back in those days, a lot of the churches had stipulations about the kind of people that they would allow inside. And so individuals like the homeless, the widow, the orphan, those who were drunkards, the prostitutes, individuals that did not fit that mold, William and Catherine provided an opportunity for them to have community, to meet Jesus, and to have their needs met. And so it all started with this idea of soup, soap, and salvation, having a physical need met through cleanliness of the body physically, being fed physically, and being fed spiritually. And so for over 150 years, the Salvation Army internationally has had an active presence in meeting very real needs of communities across the globe. And currently, the Salvation Army has an active presence in about 134 countries.
Wow. I shared a story with you before we went on the air that back when I was kind of the transition director of the Carthage Choir and took the group to Europe, one of the young men in the choir happened to be Salvation Army. Mm-hmm. And because of apparently the practice of the Salvation Army not to have health insurance as we think of it, they just cover the expenses as needed of their employees. And so we had, instead of being able to present proof of insurance, which is usually a requirement, I had just had this letterhead from the Salvation Army that I would have to present to somebody in Europe if Caleb had suffered a fall or fallen ill or something. And I remember thinking, gosh, I hope in Europe, in Salzburg or Vienna or wherever we are, I hope they're going to have heard of the Salvation Army. I just didn't know. And we got off the bus in Dresden, our first city in Germany, and there was this big, huge poster right on the street for the Salvation Army. I mean, it was in German, so I couldn't read every single word, but I saw that logo, and I just immediately felt this huge relief that, yes, they know about the Salvation Army here, not only know about it, but clearly the Salvation Army was active and a Absolutely. Vibrant presence there. And you tell us in 130-plus countries all over the world.
Yep.
That's
Absolutely.
Amazing. I wonder if you could give us a sense of kind of the scope of activity in terms of particularly this matter of meeting the needs of the poor and the, if we want to use an old term, the downtrodden, but those who find themselves in a lot of different difficulty. What would be some of the ways in which the Salvation Army seeks to help people?
Yeah. So what you'll find is that a lot of Salvation Army facilities, churches across the nation and the world have similar programming, but then there's also programming that's specific to each community. You may or may not know that the Salvation Army within the United States is present in every zip code, so no matter where you go, no matter where you move to, you will encounter the Salvation Army. And so in Racine specifically, so we address food insecurity in our community through our feeding programs that are geared toward children ages birth up to 17. The Healthy Kids Diner provides hot, nutritious meals Monday through Friday at four of the Racine community-oriented policing houses in partnership with the Racine Police Department. And so I have a kitchen team that's cooking meals every single day, packaging meals, and getting out into the community, distributing those meals, building relationship, which is extremely important for an organization like ours. We also have a partnership with the Racine Unified School District in which we operate a program called the Weekend Food Sacks. And so we provide additional nutritional support for identified students during the weekend. And so we have volunteers who package weekend food sacks at the Salvation Army every Thursday and Friday. And we distribute about 600 food sacks every Friday. So we're meeting real need there in addressing the idea of food insecurity in Racine. We have our client choice food pantry in which clients are able to come every 30 days to shop for food items that that they know that their family will best receive. We also offer hygiene products when available, baby diapers, formula, and a host of other household resources. There's so much that happens, right? Our emergency assistance programs where we provide rental assistance, vouchers for disasters such as house fires or floods. We have a senior center where we actually work with the Meals on Wheels program in Racine to provide hot lunches to seniors Monday through Thursday. And then once a month, we have a senior bingo, right? No no cash bingo, but just an opportunity for the seniors in our community to have fellowship, to have community, which is extremely important. And then all of that is drawn together by the fact that we are a church, as you mentioned. And so we do offer opportunities for spiritual growth and development through Bible study, through prayer meetings, through our women's ministries group, and also worship services every Sunday starting at 9:45 with Sunday school and then 10:45 with worship.
When I think about the good work that the Salvation Army does, I am taken back to 2001, the fall of 2001. I shared this story with you before we went on the air, that the young man that I mentioned earlier in my story about landing in Dresden, his mother, Jan Sjogren, also a Corps officer with the Salvation Army, came on my program because she had been dispatched to New York City to 9/11 in the wake of that catastrophe. And she talked about the work that she and others from the Salvation Army did as one of, of course, many organizations offering help. And I remember from that interview that one of the things she said was that the Salvation Army booth was, for many people, in a sense, kind of the place of last resort, because in many of the other agencies offering assistance for people dramatically affected by those events, they would have various stipulations and calculations and in order to qualify for this and that. And in a sense, the Salvation Army, more than probably any other presence there, was a place where it did not matter who you were or where you lived or what your income level was or anything else about you, the Salvation Army was ready to help you. And the way she characterized that was that that really is an abiding theme of the Salvation Army as a whole.
Yeah, that's so, and it falls in line with our mission statement, right? To preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to meet human needs in his name without discrimination. And so, like you mentioned, right, the Salvation Army is there. We're ready, willing to serve, resourced by our communities to provide resources and programs and services that meet a very real need, whether it's through food, clothing, housing, emotional, spiritual care and support, whether it's through social, emotional. The Salvation Army has always, right, had its hands out, ready to serve the people. Some people may say the Salvation Army is the people's army. Right. Yeah. And so even in my life, having the opportunity to be influenced by the work of the Salvation Army, I'm from St. Louis, born and raised. And my mom met the Salvation Army when she was about 7 years old. And from that came this lifelong lineage of service and of attending for church and having our needs met by so many. And I actually have the privilege in my role now to pastor retired Salvation Army officers who pastor my mom and her siblings back in, I don't want to say,
well, about long
the
time
70s,
ago.
Right? Like, so it's an incredible opportunity, incredible organization, and I wouldn't be sitting in this seat having this conversation had I not had that personal experience about the good and the needs that are being met holistically for many around our community, around the nation, around the world.
Yeah. Let me ask you real quick, and then we'll get into the Red Kettle campaign, which is what, of course, we really want to talk about next. But I would be very curious to know a little bit about this matter of the army. You mentioned, you know, the People's Army is one way to think of it. And, of course, that's one thing that is intriguing about the Salvation Army and makes it distinctive from many other faiths is this idea of the way it seems, at least in some ways, to be modeled after the army, and that you are a pastor and a corps officer and so on, and of course even in terms of uniforms and so on. Could you trace us back to when that began and what is seen as maybe the primary benefit of being organized in that kind of fashion and in thinking in some of those sorts of terms?
Well, from what I'm aware of, like, it really began at our foundations, at our beginnings, right? And so what you'll find is that the Salvation Army is modeled after a military structure, right? And so Salvation Army pastors are called corps officers, but you'll also know or may not know that we have a rank as if we are military personnel. So seminary students who have been called by God to engage in full-time ministry are called cadets. Right.
Wow.
Once you finish that training, you are then commissioned and ordained as a pastor, and you receive the rank of lieutenant. After 5 years of service as a lieutenant, you are promoted to the rank of captain. An additional 10 years after that, for 15, you become a major, and then ranks after that are generally given based on years of service of leadership skill and ability. And so it goes lieutenant colonel, commissioner, and then the international leader of the Salvation Army is the general.
Wow.
And so, you know, this military structure that we have, not many people understand, but it works for us. And so our church members, right, people that attend our worship services are involved with The Salvation Army in that regard are called soldiers.
Okay.
And so we look at it as the Salvation Army is God's army. And so it's been a long history and lineage of just, you know, having that structure that works.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us for part one of today's morning show, I'm speaking with Edward J. Williams III, who is a Corps officer and pastor for the Salvation Army Racine Corps and Community Center. And, of course, because it is the holidays, the Salvation Army is undertaking right now its famous Red Kettle campaign. And, of course, many of us entering maybe our local grocery store or other stores all around the community have seen those iconic red kettles. And tell us, first of all, how long that's been a part of the Salvation Army. It sounds like a long, long time. And how is this effort organized?
Yeah. The Red Kettle campaign has been around for many, many years. I'm finna say almost, I mean, obviously it's older than I am. but it began, if I'm not mistaken, in California. And so really the Red Kettle campaign is an opportunity for the community to partner with the Salvation Army to help us resource the those in need in our communities throughout the year through a lot of those programs and services that I mentioned that meet a very real need. And so the Red Kettle campaign for many accounts for about 50% of their total operating budget for the fiscal year. And wow. So it's a vitally important fundraiser for the Salvation Army. A lot of communities have a lot of need, and so they're trying to raise a lot of funds and donations to help carry them through to the next fiscal year. It's quite the operation. I've been in Salvation Army churches where we've had as many as 30 sites for bell ringing.
Wow.
Currently, the Salvation Army in Racine has about 14 or 15 sites. And so every Salvation Army facility has its own goal to reach. The Racine Salvation Army's goal this year is $320,000.
Wow.
And so that will allow us to continue serving the community without having to cut programming to, you know, reduce staff hours, but that we can continue meeting need as it comes.
So when we place coins or bills, I'm sure you like bills even more than coins, but whatever people choose to place into one of those red kettles, that goes directly to the Racine Corps and Community Center. And directly assists what happens here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all the money's raised through the Red Kettle stays within the community. It doesn't go anywhere else. We're not supporting any other, you know, programs outside of the Salvation Army. But if you donate in Racine, you can trust and believe that your donations will stay to help the people in Racine.
Right. And likewise, for somebody who would deposit mm-hmm. into a red kettle here in Kenosha, for
yes,
instance,
absolutely.
that same principle then applies. Right.
Absolutely.
And the people who are, in a sense, operating those kettles, I'm assuming that some of them are part of the Salvation Army themselves, but that maybe some are just volunteers who want to support the good work you do. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's a mix of volunteers who support the mission and work of the Salvation Army. But then we also provide an opportunity for individuals within our community to earn some income by being bell ringers as well. And so not only are they out raising donations for the Salvation Army, but I'd like to look at it as the Salvation Army provides an opportunity for those who maybe aren't able to work or for whatever reason don't have an income or maybe on a set income.
Sure.
To just earn, you know, some extra, you know, money to help support themselves and all they're experiencing. So it's a lot of good. We have a lot of great bell ringers who have great personalities. And with this type of fundraiser, you need people who are engaging, who can hold conversation, who, you know, will just get out there and engage the community in such fantastic ways. And so we're blessed with a number of bell ringers who do so. We're blessed with a number of volunteer groups that believe and support what we do. And so it helps to have those individuals come alongside.
Very good. And if somebody, for instance, is walking into the grocery store and they see the red kettle, but at that moment in time, nobody happens to be there, typically, can they still make a donation? I mean, I know those kettles are kind of locked in place and so on, and locked up tight. But, I mean, should they consider any time they see a red kettle that it is available to receive a donation?
Yeah, absolutely. What you'll find is that sometimes it is difficult. to find enough people to be positioned at a red kettle all the time.
Sure, and around the clock. That'd be impossible.
So you will find that there are moments when some stores have individuals and volunteer groups and some stores don't. So if you pass a red kettle and it's unmanned, I would say yes, feel free to donate to the Salvation Army. Drop a few coins, drop, you know, a dollar or whatever you feel you're led to give. It all goes towards a great cause. But the Salvation Army has also caught up with the times for individuals who maybe don't carry cash. And so at some of our kettle locations, you will find what we call tap-to-give devices. And these are electronic devices that allow you to donate using your debit, credit card, Apple Pay, Google Pay. And it's 100% safe and secure. It only collects the amount of the donation that you choose. No personal information. And so if you see those, that's another opportunity, right? If you see an unmanned kettle and one of those devices are there, feel free to go ahead.
Fascinating. That's great. And I assume the Salvation Army has some kind of an online presence. Is there a website that people can visit if they are curious to find out even more information than we've explored today?
Absolutely. You can go to the Salvation Army Racine's website, which is www.saracine.org.
Very good. Edward J. Williams III, Corps Officer and Pastor for the Salvation Army Racine Corps and Community Center. It's been great to speak with you today.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you so much, and best wishes to you and all of your colleagues at the Salvation Army.
Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm pleased and honored to be speaking with one of our country's most acclaimed and successful authors of fiction for young adult readers. Livia Blackburn is responsible for an array of best-selling books, including The Queen's Counsel, Midnight Thief, Poison Dance, Rosemarked, and many other best-selling novels. But her most recent book is a children's book and a picture book called I Dream of Papo. She tells us that it is a work of fiction, but it is definitely drawn from her own real-life experience. When Livia Blackburn was 5 years old, she and her parents emigrated from Taiwan to the United States. And Livia had to say farewell to her beloved grandmother, or Papo. I Dream of Papo talks about that powerful relationship between grandmother and granddaughter and how that relationship changed with the distance between them geographically and also with the passage of time. It's a deeply poignant, beautiful book. It's published by Roaring Brook Press. Again, it's titled I Dream of Papo. Let's begin with what I just touched on, the fact that this is, as you say in the author's note, a work of fiction, yet one which is drawn very clearly, very heavily, from your own life's experience. Let's talk first of all about your own life's experience and the parallels that there are between it and the story of this young girl in I Dream of Papo.
Oh, of course. Like the girl in I Dream of Papo, I was also born in Taiwan. And I lived there until I was five. And while I was growing up there, my Papo, maternal grandmother, as you mentioned, was my one of my main caretakers. So, you know, I saw her every day. She cooked delicious meals for us, you know, took me to the park. And, you know, when I was five, I moved to the United States with my parents, and of course my Papo stayed behind, and our relationship changed by necessity. You know, we still loved each other, but we were talking on the phone now instead of, you know, talking on the phone once a week instead of seeing each other every day. And also I started to lose my Chinese, which made it harder for me to communicate with her and my other relatives back in Taiwan. And so my popo passed away when I was a teenager, and once in a while I'll have dreams of her, and the dreams will be about different things. But one common thread between them would be that we would be having these long, intimate conversations in English, which is something we were never able to do when she was actually alive. So it's always kind of bittersweet waking up from them. And, after having one of those dreams, that was the spark that ignited the book, the idea of immigrant girl speaking to her Chinese grandmother in English and dreaming about it.
Hmm. Did anything in particular prompt you to want to sit down and write this book? I mean, was there some event in your own life or some event in the world that made you want to share this story with the world in this way?
It was, I had a daughter, as happens to many people. Before that, I was a young adult author, writing young adult novels, and suddenly I had this toddler that I was reading picture books to, and I was reading, several books from the library every week, which adds up to hundreds of books per year, and I just fell in love with, that art form. I hadn't read them since I was a child, and I had forgotten just, what works of art they are. And I think that combined with, I was, thinking about family a lot more, thinking about heritage a lot more, trying to teach Chinese to my daughter and all that, became the book.
Back to your own story for just a moment before we explore the specific story of I Dream of Papo. When your family moved here to the United States, what was that experience like for you? How challenging was it? How exciting was it? What do you remember most vividly about your earliest experiences here?
Yeah, I was five and very excited, although not quite realizing what it meant at the time. I knew we were going to get on a plane, and I loved planes. I do remember my mom was sad, crying as we left. She wanted to come. She was just sad that she was leaving her family behind. And then we came here. I was coming from a tropical island, never seen snow in my life, and we landed down in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the middle of winter. I think it was 27 degrees Fahrenheit, and there was no jetway. So just I remember just, sprinting across the tarmac, and it's like, what's this cold? And then meeting, my dad's friends and coworkers here for the first time, just remembering how they looked very different. I was used to seeing Chinese people, and I remember specifically his boss picked me up really high, and he was really tall, and I just remember being really high off the ground. And then in Albuquerque, there were a lot of new experiences. The landscape was different. We made our first snowman when it snowed. Like in Albuquerque, it'll snow maybe 4 inches once a year or something. Except we had no idea how to do it, and we didn't know you could roll a snowball and make it bigger. So we just piled up a little pile of snow and put a face on it, and we were very proud of it. And then, of course, there was the language, too. So I got there in the middle of kindergarten. They just dropped me right into school, and I don't remember much of that. I feel like I was kind of clueless. I must have picked up the language gradually somehow, because, gradually I started understanding. And apparently when I was in first grade, one of my classmates went back home and said, "Hey, Mom, Livia talked today." So, at some point I started talking, too. From there, I just fairly quickly became Americanized.
Hmm. And I'm curious, at what point did writing become important to you?
Writing, I was always a bookworm. I was an only child, so read tons and tons of books. Whenever we had to write stories for school, I got really into it. The first time I took a serious crack at a novel was actually in high school, and it was to get out of a mandatory camping trip, because we had one of those weird progressive high schools where we had to go out and like camp for experiential education, and you know, this is the kind of camping where it's not car camping. You know, it's just a week in the wilderness, no showers, digging holes through the bathroom. And I did one of those trips, and I was like, okay, you know, if I can get out of this character building experience in any way possible, I will I will do it. And so there was an option that you could do where you could propose your own activity, your own project instead of camping. So I was like, well, maybe I can write a novel. It's kind of like camping in your head. And to my surprise, they accepted it. And so in high school, I started what would be 80 pages of a novel, and it was a horrible novel. But I had a very good English teacher who mentioned, you know, your main character, like, is not the most interesting character, but she has a friend who is incredibly interesting. And so I kind of tucked that away. And being a good Asian student, never thought that I would actually be a writer. And so I went to school for science. I studied biochemistry at Harvard and then went to MIT for my PhD in neuroscience. And, you know, I kind of pivoted away from writing for a while. But there was one time, my third year of grad school, I was waiting for the bus at Harvard Medical School, and it was snowing. And so I went into the bookstore to stay warm while the bus came, and there was a display on the table of a popular young adult series at the time about a girl and her vampire boyfriend. Some people might recognize that, but I started reading it and finished the series over the weekend and just remembered how much I loved writing. And I decided, you know, I should start again. So I took that side character from my first high school novel and turned it into its own novel, which ended up, you know, more successful than my dissertation, and I kind of pivoted and became a writer and never looked back.
You certainly did. You accomplished that pivot, of course, spectacularly well, and many people know the array of novels that you have created, like Poison Dance and Midnight Thief and The Queen's Council and many, many others. And I know at least many of those designed with what is the specific term for the kind of audience for whom you are I think most often writing?
Let's see. So that would be, those would be young adults, high schoolers and middle schoolers.
Right.
I'm hoping to write more also for kids and also kind of older elementary as well. We'll see how that works.
So I'm curious, what did it feel like, speaking of pivots, to pivot from writing for high school, young adult, to shifting your attention to something very much for young children, or at least mostly this book is designed with, I should think, very, very young readers in mind. What did that feel like, or is that something you have done before, and how different an enterprise does it feel for you compared to the
right.
other kind of writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I kind of compare writing novels and writing picture books to, say, building a ship versus building a ship in a bottle. So, you know, with a novel, you're kind of hacking off these big pieces and moving them around, and you're toiling for hours under the hot sun. And picture books, you know, they're 500 words, and you know, you're moving these tiny pieces. Every single word matters. You're going in there with tweezers, and it's still difficult work. Maybe not as long hours, but you know, very precise work. And also, you know, the feel of the work is very different. You know, so teenagers, you know, writing for teenagers, and it was all high drama, swoony romance scenes, that kind of like fun stuff. But you know, it's a very different feel from writing for children, where it kind of gets you to kind of focus on, you know, there's something really nice and wholesome about picture books. You know, you're kind of focusing on some really like important themes, like love, family. Usually that comes out, and so it kind of gets you to think about what's important, like, and what kind of messages you want to share through your literature.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Livia Blackburn, and we are talking about a wonderful children's book that she has just created called I Dream of Papo. And this is quite a dramatic departure from the kind of novels for which she is so renowned. So as we've touched on, this book is fiction, but drawn from your own life. Can you just say a word about how that works? That is, the relationship between the events in this book and events in your own life. And if you, in some respects, were you sort of consciously deciding, well, I'm going to keep this from my life, but this part of my life doesn't work so well, so I think I'll turn it into this, or is it more of kind of a general experience where there's this basic story you want to tell that just happens to bear some resemblance to your own life?
Right. I think what's truest in the story are the emotions and just general experience of being kind of far away from a loved one, maybe having cultural differences, cultural language differences from a loved one. I was fairly sure that I didn't want it exactly my story, mostly because it felt a little too vulnerable, I think. So I'm used to writing fantasy where it's magic, and I have my experiences in my novels as well, but there's layers and layers of magic and magical creatures to kind of shield it all. And this picture book, it didn't have any of that, so it was a much more raw experience for me. And so I did want to make some differences, so the physical details, the place where the girl lived was San Diego instead of Albuquerque, and part of that was because San Diego, I feel like, is more it's more familiar to more of the mainstream audience, so they'd be able to identify with that right away, even if they wouldn't be able to identify with the Taiwan part of it. I was tweaking the details, like the foods that they ate weren't exactly the foods that my popo ate for me, made for me, just to make it easier to write, I think. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really lovely about this book, and it's one of the reasons why I think, and I would hope that a wide array of people, including a wide array of children, will read it, is that you introduce us, that is, those of us with no connection to Taiwanese traditions, to what some of those traditions are. And I think they're woven into the book in a really nice, organic way. We don't feel like we're being sort of clobbered over the head with, lessons about Taiwanese tradition. It's just something that just emerges very, very naturally out of this story. For instance, very early on, as you're describing some of the scenes that this young girl has back in Taiwan before her family has moved here, an interesting tradition that involves New Year's Eve. Tell our listeners about that, about this tradition.
Yes. Chinese New Year, there's quite a few traditions there. It's the biggest, it's Lunar New Year is celebrated by many Asian cultures, and in Chinese culture, it's the biggest festival of the year. And several traditions, one of my favorites is, it's also the favorite of children, Chinese children everywhere, I think, is red envelopes, where on New Year's, you will bow to your elders, wish them a happy New Year's, and they will give you red envelopes with money inside. That's always a lot of fun. It seems like a good deal when you're growing up, but then you realize once you get married, you have to give red envelopes to your parents now, and to the older folks, it kind of flips, and now the denominations are much bigger. So it's actually a bit of a trick, I think. There's also the New Year's dinner, which is absolutely delicious, and all kinds of foods that are very symbolic of the New Year. So you'll have noodles for long life. You'll have fish, which it's yu in Chinese, which is the same word as extra. So, if you eat fish on New Year's, you'll have lots of extra over the New Year. There's also nian gao, sticky rice cake, which again is a kind of a play on words, because the word for sticky, nian, is also the word for year. Lots of food, lots of time with family.
One of the things that leapt out at me as this little girl in your book is departing Taiwan for the United States is that she does not appear especially sad or especially scared. And from what it sounds like, what you describe of your own experience is that you, when you left Taiwan, it was with no real understanding of just geographically what a gulf there was going to be between you and your grandmother. And so I appreciate the authenticity of that choice you make in how you sort of frame that moment in the story. When this little girl gets to the United States, one really poignant moment you show us is when she is in school and learning certain words and doing certain assignments, in which we start to see, in a sense, a slight tilting away from the world that she had known and into this new life with new words. Tell us more, our listeners, more about what I'm talking about, and again, how much this maybe reflects your own experiences when your family first moved here.
All right. So, the little girl, she goes to the U.S. and, starts learning English. She learns more words for Popo, like grandma and, school bus, lots of new words in English. And, she thinks, the word grandma, it sounds strange to call her that because she's Popo. But gradually, she becomes more comfortable in English, and then she realizes when she goes back to Taiwan, calling her Popo again, that, now it's Popo that sounds strange in her mouth, and, that she has trouble catching words in Chinese. She says it's like kind of fish in a deep well. It just becomes more of a reach to get those words, and so, she doesn't quite realize it, but, gradually she's losing the language, and it's affecting her relationships. There's also another line. She says, I ask Mama why I can't talk to Popo like before, and Mama says you can still hug her as tight as before, and Popo hugs her tighter. So it's kind of the tension between, communication, maybe being unable to communicate as well, but still having that bond underneath.
Right. And that the love is absolutely there. It is as intense as it ever was, but it's a love that, in a sense, the language of that love or the means of expressing that love have to change a little bit. And I also appreciate, but I'm curious about the choice you made to very, very much focus on this little girl and her grandmother. I mean, it's not that the parents aren't present at all, but it is very focused on these two characters very specifically. Can you just say a word about what was behind that choice?
I think mostly that was my the initial spark. It was inspired by my dreams about my Popo and my complicated emotions about my relationship with her and wishing sometimes I could have spoken to her. In terms of the focus of the story, that's how it started. And, picture book, you have only 500 words, so you want to shine a spotlight on, the theme that you want to hit, and that's about it.
Yeah, I think the focus really makes sense. And I'm sure for a youngster experiencing this book, they will be drawn very deeply into that relationship. I also want to mention that towards the end of the book, you include a glossary.
Yes.
Just explain why this glossary is here and in a sense, the function or purpose it serves.
Writing a book about a girl immigrating from Taiwan, it's you kind of can't avoid having Chinese words, so they're sprinkled in there, gong gong popo, and all the foods that they have, random things that appear in her life. And so there's always choices that you make, like, do you want to have have everything in English or a smattering in Chinese? And we did want the Chinese in there, but then there were also choices, like, do we want to define it in the story itself or later, and we didn't want to break up the story, and we kind of thought, you know, readers would be able to figure it out, and, you know, we would put the glossary at the end for anyone who wanted to delve more deeply into it.
That's a nice choice. Let's finish by having you share with our listeners a lovely phrase that that your own grandmother used quite often with you, and which Papo uses in this book as well. One of those phrases that, when literally translated, sort of takes us aback, but which is beautiful and sweet at its heart.
Right. So that is bei bei xing, bei bei gan, and it's not a common phrase in Chinese. I think it was just something that my grandmother said, and literally translated, it means baby heart, baby liver. So in Chinese, people often use liver as an expression of affection, you know, kind of like sweetheart or something, except like the sweet liver. You know, and it's the same idea that, you know, it's something that's so close to you, like so vital to you, like your liver is vital to your body. A more common phrase would be xin gan bao bei, which is kind of a similar, similarly translated as sweetheart.
Mm. I just love that. And it speaks on the one hand of how distinctive people can be from one another, and yet how much we share so many of the same hopes and dreams and feelings. Even as we look closely and revel in what makes us distinct from one another, something like that also just reminds us about the universality of a grandmother's love for her granddaughter. And that lives so vividly in this wonderful book, again called I Dream of Papo, published by Roaring Brook Press and the author Livia Blackburn. Livia Blackburn, what a pleasure and honor for me to speak with you, and thank you so much for sharing with the world this lovely book.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am replaying a conversation from 2022 with Laura Gelat, now a retired history professor from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. It's a conversation about a book that she wrote called Helen Perry Curtis and the European Trip of a Lifetime. Helen Perry Curtis was the author of a book that many, many people, many, many young people in America of a certain age read when they were young. And this book by Laura Gelat tells the real-life story of the author of that book, which was called Jean and Company. And it was a wonderful odyssey of exploration and discovery, which Laura Gelat recounts. And we'll hear all about that tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, I will welcome into our studios Dr. Art Sear, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, for his monthly visit to the program, his last visit to The Morning Show in 2024. And on Friday, we honor the memory of Dr. Tom Knorr, a longtime history professor at Carthage, by replaying a conversation with him about the legacy of John F. Kennedy. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Well, Mother Nature has defied the weather forecast and is giving us sunshine, even though the forecast was for cloudy skies today. We're headed for a high of 39 degrees. Cloudy skies are expected tonight, along with possibly an inch of snow, with an overnight low of 28 degrees. Cloudy tomorrow with a high of 33. It looks like we will have a 60% chance of some light snowfall on Thursday with a high of 33 degrees, and light snow could linger into Friday as well with a high of 32 and a little bit colder as we get into the weekend under mostly sunny skies. Daytime highs only in the upper 20s to right around 30 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.